Hey, J. Crew, this episode is being hosted by three Jews still a little bit hungover from the wedding of the century. Our minds are a little bit foggy and we have no idea what we might say. It might be a little bit inappropriate. And so this is your obscenity warning. Yeah, I mean, your grandmother might have had sex for the first time on her wedding night. I mean, there's lots of things about your grandmother, right? You know?
I hope she did. I mean, I hope she had, you know. Now, oh, I don't want to think about that.
Hello, J. Crew. This is Unorthodox, the world's leading Jewish podcast. I am your host, Mark Oppenheimer. Just back from the wedding of the century, I am joined this week by Tablet senior writer Liel Leibowitz.
Don't talk so loud. Still hungover.
Sorry. I'll try to dial it back. And substituting for the honeymooning Stephanie Butnick is our executive producer, Alyssa Goldstein. Hello, Alyssa.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm so happy to be here and to be promoted to executive producer. It's very exciting.
I promoted you a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
I don't know if you noticed that.
Yeah, no, I'm thrilled. My parents love it.
If you want another title, I mean, you know, these things are all, they're flexible. I mean, we can make you Dolly Grip or Gaffer or whatever. Our guests this week are essayist and NPR commentator Annabelle Gurwitch and the Jew-Gentile combo of actor Aaron Davidman and director Dylan Kussman, who together made the movie Wrestling Jerusalem, which I have seen and which I've led a panel discussion of and which is playing this week in New York. And it's a remarkable thing. So it's going to be exciting to have them in the studio. But before we get to that, Jews, what is up? We know what's up. What was up this weekend?
The wedding of the century. You know, I'm sorry. I'm gonna let you finish, Charles and Diana. But the Butnick-Cohen wedding is one of the greatest weddings of all time.
I don't know about you guys. I felt like a minor celebrity, and I'm not even on the podcast like you are. But still, felt like I was recognized by virtue of my accent or Instagram or something.
Right, and there were also like at least three different categories of people who'd come up to us. You know, some of them come up to us and be like, do you do that thing in the place with Stephanie that she works on? And we're like, yeah, we do that thing. And then there'd be people who would come up and be like, wait, I think I've seen your picture or I heard your voice. Are you on Unorthodox with Stephanie? And you'd say yes. And then they'd want a photo with you. And then there were the people who would walk up like, you know, Aunt Pam and Cousin Amy and people like that who were just awestruck. Like they knew us, they knew our kids' names, they knew the guests on every episode ever. I mean, the super fans. And that was flattering if...
love these people.
Yeah.
And love the Butnick-Cohens. I mean, seriously, the
so
funnest, warmest, kind of happiest wedding. It's, to me, it was almost an anthropological experience to kind of like see just like very large, very happy families genuinely seem to love each other. I felt like I'm on safari. It's like, and here you have the North American happy family. They come out at night to celebrate with vodka and dancing. I was like, who are these strange tribal people?
Right. The Butnicks and the Cohens, all the Machatunim seem to actually love each other. I mean, there seems to be no drama, no stress. Ben's sister loves him. Stephanie's sister loves her. It's all good. It's all good.
It's almost obscene.
Now, listen, we were very fortunate in that at about halftime in the wedding, we were able to get a yichud room. We were able to like retreat into just a social room away from the tent, inside the country club, away from the outdoor tent. And we did a little mini.
Okay. All right. This is the Butnick-Cohen wedding halftime show. We're inside the Old Westbury Golf, Tennis, and Bocce Society Club.
Has everyone met Uncle Leslie?
Uncle Leslie.
He makes Joe Nathan's chopped liver.
I'm a big supporter.
He's an early supporter
of both the podcast and of Stephanie Butnick. Always my favorite Butnick from early on.
So Molly Ye is
a special guest.
Molly.
Wait, we have another special guest. Molly Ye is here. Can we talk about Stephanie and Ben? Here's what Stephanie and Ben are in my mind. Do you remember the most beautiful camp counselor and the most handsome boy counselor, how you always wanted them to get together? And that was like your definition of love growing up?
We just did. In front of our very eyes.
This was my old camp self's biggest fantasy coming true tonight. Ben Cohen,
hello.
Groom, how are you feeling?
I'm feeling good. I'm trying to... Stephanie both has to pee and change out of her dress into her jumpsuit, so I'm trying to...
Hopefully in the proper order.
Stephanie has a wedding jumpsuit. This is amazing.
Is it a romper? Does she have a wedding romper?
It's a jumpsuit. It has legs. So the most important thing that happened tonight was that during the ceremony, a black cat with white on it walked by the front of the... Like, I saw him from the hood, but he walked by the front. And I was like, it's a sign. This is meant to be. Cat Stevens is pissed he's not invited. And I was like, we can do this.
I paid several $1,000 for that cat to walk past.
I feel very happy. I feel like this is a little anticlimactic. Like, what are we going to talk about after this?
Babies. Mark's going to talk about babies.
That's exactly right.
All right. Well, we're going to go make some, so let's go.
All right. Goodbye.
Bye.
I think any life event I'm ever having should be orchestrated by Howie and Elise Butnick. I just don't want to be in an event anymore that they don't throw.
They know how to throw an event.
What is the point?
They know how to throw an event.
Including, I know you're supposed to talk about the ladies' dresses, and Stephanie looked amazing. It was
amazing.
Seriously a stunning wedding dress. You know, whatever. Here's what got my attention. Got my attention is that Howie Butnick switched from the black tuxedo of the ceremony to a white tuxedo of the reception, which was smashing. I mean, seriously, the man is an inspiration.
I think, of course, another toast for Howie Butnick.
Howie Butnick.
Who's wearing the cleverest tux I've ever seen in my life.
You are the best dressed man here.
Howie, what's it like to, I mean, honestly, earnestly now, what's it like to be marrying off your baby daughter? What is this like?
You know, everyone thinks, oh, the baby daughter going, but they're adults. I don't think about, like, oh, it's the youngest daughter. Oh, my God. They're people. You know, yes, you can hover, you can helicopter, but still.
Howie, you know what? Stephanie,
let them be.
Stephanie seems well-raised to me, and that's my highest compliment.
I disagree with when people say, oh, you did a good job raising your kids. I don't agree with that. You know, you did a good job raising. No, they did the job. I didn't do anything.
No, we're gonna celebrate you anyway for that tux. If nothing else, could we get a picture of the tux? We
make sure
the picture. You did, okay?
Yeah.
Because like, I sometimes dress a little eccentrically, and it's like you have given me license.
Howie Butnick is. He's an eccentric and proudly so.
At least you look beautiful too. But Howie, yeah. I'm sorry, man.
Now, Leo, we discovered actually you were not eating so much the other night, and it was a big reveal to me and Alyssa that you've made some dietary choices lately.
I have, Mark. This is as close to Oprah as I'll ever be.
Yeah, do you want to share with our listeners?
It's time to share.
I'll begin by saying that, you know, as you could imagine, the food at the wedding, I mean, it was out of
unbelievable.
It was just the most unbelievable thing.
Yeah.
But here's the rub. So, you know, the month of Elul, in which we are now, is a month of reflection and kind of thought and contemplation. And for quite some time now, I've been, I mean, this is not a new thing. This is something I've been kind of thinking about and experiencing for some months. I'm trying to go kosher here. I'm trying to keep it real.
Okay.
And
now,
so the bounties at Stephanie's wedding were very appealing and enticing, but I had some lovely sushi rolls and a very good vegetarian option. And somewhere in the twilight zone, you know, a slightly previous version of me heard myself, this version of me, order the vegetarian option when steak was offered. And, you know, the planets are just, you know.
So why?
I think that as you sort of, you know, this there's very little about this that sounds original or interesting, I'm afraid. But I think that as you sort of mature and start, I mean, eventually you mature. Even me, you know, at some point you have to. And as that happens to you, I think you start thinking about what really matters to you and how you want to sort of go through life. And I think that, you know, my Jewish identity and my commitment to this religion, not just, you know, some ethnic affiliation. But faith has always mattered a great deal for me. I always thought that there was a really kind of effortless way for me to kind of intellectually paper over some of these kind of central distinctions that Judaism commands. It turns out it's not quite so easy. The more serious I get, the harder it got for me to justify to myself, you know, why I was still eating bacon and cheeseburger. Look, the honest answer is that I don't have a good answer for you. I'm just doing right now what feels right. And I think that the intellectual thought will come much, much later. But you know what? It feels kind of great.
You're having your like Na'aseh v'nishma moment.
Yeah, that's right.
You're doing
it. You want to translate for the goyim over here, including me.
When God offered the Israelites the Torah, they basically said, "We'll do it, and then we'll listen." Like mm-hmm. they committed on the basis of faith, yeah. and then the commentary and the intellectualism came later.
Yeah,
there's also something amazing in this age of excess about the idea of restriction, I think, you know, it makes me feel really good to know, look, I'm in command of what I eat. I think it may be in a weird way started from kind of like, you know, deciding to commit to losing, you know, all this weight. It's sort of like, look, I'm not just going to sort of, you know, gorge myself on anything and everything that I find. I'm going to think very, very carefully about what it is that I ingest. And I think it really gives you a sense of, to use a loathsome word, mindfulness. That really brings order to the chaos.
I feel like my trajectory with kashrut is so there's been many rises and dips over the last 10 years. I grew up keeping kosher, and my parents' home is kosher, and we would eat out meals vegetarian in restaurants. But like, grew up in a religious community where most of the families kept kosher, and in the last few years, I've sort of, and I was pretty strict about it until I was in my mid-20s. And even now, I very rarely eat meat that is treif. But at some point, I had this thought that I didn't want to not experience everything that the world had to offer. It wasn't out of any theological point of view, because for me, kashrut isn't theological. It's more cultural. Like my theology and religious beliefs stalled when I was about 9 and hasn't advanced beyond like, you know, vanilla agnosticism. But it's just so interesting because for me, it's kind of divorced from faith. It's just like what we do, and it's not really about what I believe. Yeah.
I think that makes perfect sense, though.
Yeah.
I think, yeah. I mean, well, it'll be interesting. Our readers will keep us honest.
I think part of its design actually was to do just that, to say like, look, you know.
I never want my relationship with food and kashrut to not be fraught. As long as it's fraught, and as long as I'm thinking about it and I'm feeling
you're
some degree of guilt, I'm in the right place.
You're in shoe. Of course it's going to be. Your relationship with everything is going to be fraught. What isn't going to be fraught?
There will be no news of the Jews this week as important as Liel's having decided to try keeping kosher. But a quick other bit of news of the Jews. First of all, Prime Minister Netanyahu's son had posted an anti-Semitic meme to his Facebook page. What was the meme? I forget. It was
a Nazi thing, but
George Soros holding a fishing rod in front of a lizard person. The lizard person holding a fishing rod in front of, I believe, a hook-nosed Jew, who then in turn was fishing the world government, which shows you that, you know, morons come in all shapes, sizes, religious affiliations,
so,
beliefs,
I don't know
and
much
family
about
lineage.
I don't know much about Netanyahu's son. Is he like the? Is he the?
He's the Don
Trump
Jr. Yep.
That's perfect.
He's working his way to an Eric, but for now he's the Don Jr.
Right. An Orthodox woman has settled her lawsuit with the gym Lucille Roberts. She won the right to exercise in her skirt after she was turned away by two women's Lucille Roberts gyms in Brooklyn. Yosefa Jalal Wood Eisenberg, 27. She sued Lucille Roberts in 2015 because she was banned from its franchises for wearing her knee-length fitted ortho-frummy skirts. So good for her.
Good for you. Yay.
Yeah. I've never exercised in a Lucille Roberts, and I have no plans to. But if I ever am going to, I'm gonna check at the door to see, would you let me exercise in a skirt if I wanted?
You'd look ravishing.
And finally, in news of the Jews, most important, and Liel, you wrote about this in the Scroll Tablets blog this week. Tell our listeners, tell the J. Crew the bacon story from the story of how pork creates solidarity between Islam and Judaism and creates world is the template for world peace.
That's
coming
right,
out
Mark,
of Michigan.
This is not a pork story. This is a peace story.
It's
so
a peace story.
So in the great American city of Detroit. There have been two incidents that I feel kind of show us the way towards redemption. In one case, a lovely Muslim observant couple walked into a KFC and they ask for their delicious sandwich, and they ask for no bacon on the sandwich, but cheese. And when they received said sandwich did, alas, have bacon in it. And when, to their great terror, they bit into it and discovered the you know, extremely non-halal violation they just committed, the restaurant's employees seemed to sort of laugh it off. In other news, or as Sex in the City used to say, meanwhile, on the other side of town, an Orthodox Jewish woman walked into an equally delightful Denny's and ordered the...
Also in Detroit?
Also in Detroit, and ordered the egg, the egg vegetable omelet, which you would think is the healthy option on the menu, but I checked that menu. That is like 1,100 calories.
There's like 12 eggs in that.
There's like 12 eggs and like a pound and a half of cheese. And when it was delivered to her, she took a bite and discovered also bacon. And again, to her great distress, when she complained to the manager said, "Oh, I'm really sorry. We keep the this is the literal quote. We keep the vegetable bucket next to the bacon bucket," which is a perfect description of a Denny's kitchen, right? And so both of these individuals did the most American thing they could, which, of course, they sued. And so now we have two bacon-related lawsuits directed at two different fast food franchises, one by a religious Muslim, one by a religious Jew.
God bless the...
God bless America.
Let us hope that they're settled for millions.
That's right.
That's right.
Because that would be the most American thing of all.
Sue me, sue me, shoot bullets through me. I love you.
Our first Jew of the week is Annabelle Gurwitch, actress, activist, New York Times bestselling author, guest star on Seinfeld and Boston Legal and so much else. Her most recent collection of essays is called Wherever You Go, There They Are, Stories About My Family You Might Relate To. It came out a couple months ago. It's awesome. She also used to host Dinner and a Movie on TBS. I mean, it's like you've seen her everywhere. Hi, Annabelle. Welcome.
Hey. Thanks for having me. Actually, I am playing a rabbi. I'm playing Pam Adlon's rabbi on Better Things, the TV series on FX. I think it airs October 7th.
Have you been like delving into other TV rabbis for inspiration or guidance?
There's Catherine Hahn.
Right.
It's pretty funny. It's like there's like a cache of like TV rabbi.
I love
types.
That now that you prepare to be a rabbi these days, you don't actually study real rabbis. You study Catherine Hahn.
She's the ultimate rabbi.
She's the ultimate rabbi.
She is.
So listen, there's like a million things. Like this book
you.
Alone, I feel like, first of all, it's amazing. Second of all, like every essay in this book, I think merits like a 3.5 hour conversation.
Totally.
And can I just give listeners like like the TLDR sort of what your family is like? It's like Wes Anderson meets Woody Allen. It's just hilarious and nutty and with like a Southern vibe.
Yeah, meets The Wire.
It meets Arrested Development right. because
meets
of
weeds.
The criminal
weeds.
Yeah, activity.
Right.
I mean, in the book, you know, the launching off point of the book is my family. I mean, the idea of the book was to say, you know, who is our family? Is it our birth family? Is it our relations? Is it our pets? Is it our friends? Is it our tribe? Is it our ethnic background? I mean, I really wanted to ask this question because I was that person who was always like, get me out of this family. It was like a hostage situation. And in order to tell the story, I ended up doing all this research about my family, the things I didn't even know about really how we got to this country and why we ended up in Alabama. You know, we're the Shalom Yal Jews who were, you know, lost and in Alabama. We came over and that's where we came from the old country. And
I should interrupt here to say that if your family ever imported farm equipment in Mobile, Alabama, they got it from my family's Jews, who are the farm equipment importing kings of Mobile.
That's so funny because
establish the connection,
yes.
Annabelle.
Yeah. And my dad claims, you know, my dad always claimed to have actually done the. And this is a true story. We know this that Jewish boys were sent up from the South to New York right when Israel was being formed, and they packed what was labeled farm equipment, but it was really
arms in the book.
That went to Israel.
Yes.
Now I can't prove that my dad was part of this. My dad was a big fabulist. I mean, there it was hard to tell what was true, wasn't
Harry.
True. Handsome Harry, but it could have been true. It's funny because a lot of the things don't seem true in the book. Like, did he really try to bribe a federal judge when he was 12? Was he really sent to D.C. to try to keep my cousins out of prison? That was true.
So, that's unbelievable.
So the farm equipment's like, well, you know, probably. But so in the book, you know, I tell the story, our immigrant story, but then I talk about in these different essays, the different families I joined trying to escape my family, like the UFO cult, the theater tribe, mm-hmm. You know, are our pets our family? I mean, I take it sort of far afield from my own family.
So my favorite essay of yours is the one where you talk about being your mother's drug mule.
Yeah.
Maybe you just want to – you will do greater justice to it than I. How exactly did you end up porting drugs for your mom?
So when a couple years ago my mom had like neuropathic pain in her hands and I was like, okay, you know what? I'm going to get you edibles and this THC edibles. And it's really hard to get in Florida even though it's legal. I got my – license, my marijuana license, based on information of where to go for my teenage son. And just by the way, when you get your license in California, the doctor that I went to is the only medical professional's office I've ever been to that sell flaming hot Cheetos. Yeah. It's just like, oh, great.
That's actually a huge part of the new Republican healthcare bill. It's like flaming hot Cheetos in every doctor's office. It'll just improve everyone's, you know, well-being.
Yeah. So I end up getting this stuff from these lemon drops and from my parents. And I hear like my dad's like, can you send some more? And it turned out, of course, that my mom, who had the pain, wasn't taking them at all. It was my dad who was apparently stoned all the time.
Who was dealing with your mom.
Exactly, because he was living with my mom. And my dad, I found out later, you know, he got in trouble because he was smuggling bacon into the kosher kitchen of the Jewish senior living home that they were living in. And then I found out later, it wasn't just bacon, it was crab meat. And it's very possible that he was also maybe had a little side business with the edibles.
Dealing edibles or dealing trafe?
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Yeah, the dealer in the senior home is the guy who will like hook you up with some scallops and a pig in the blanket.
So let me ask you this question, and that one on a totally serious note. So kind of one thought that occurred to me that you kind of, you know, broached a little bit. But, you know, here you are having had this very, shall we say, dramatic, tempestuous childhood. And I don't want to, you know, reveal too much because everyone who's listening to the show ought to go out and pay money and buy this book and read it. But then your parents grow older, and you take sort of extraordinarily good care of them. Was there ever a moment in which you said, you know, they were not the most responsible adults when I was coming up? I'm going to pay them in kind. I'm going to say, like, I'm sorry. I'm not going to, you know, throw everything and just come and be there for you, although maybe that's what I ought to do. In theory, I just don't feel it.
I mean, I was working on these stories for years before I actually put this book together. The reason why I started writing this particular book was that moment where I decided to step into caregiving for my parents. And I felt like as a human, I was in this challenging moment where I could say, you know, my dad lost my bat mitzvah money playing poker. There were so many reasons why I could have stepped away and not stepped in. And not that I'm any kind of great person. I mean, I'm not, it's not that. I just felt like I had this opportunity. You know, it's interesting. There's an article in the New York Times recently called The Daughter Trap about how the majority of caregiving falls to daughters in the family. And now they're only daughters in my family. So in a way, it's not exactly that situation. But I in my mind, it was funny when I read that, I also thought, well, you know, it's also the daughter opportunity.
There's something about seeing your parents being caregivers to their parents that's incredibly profound. And this is maybe a little sentimental, but it is the month of Elul. And I think there's a kind of repair or kind of tikkun between you and your parents in your caregiving for them.
Yeah.
And it's also a profound gift to your son, because for me, seeing my parents care for their elderly parents was it really has had a huge impact on me. It's a very it's an act of grace, and it's really important, I think, when younger generations witness that happening as well.
This is just actually was the anniversary of my father's death last week. And then my mother died on the day of his memorial. Both my parents died while I was writing this book. And the really, really crazy, ironic thing was that I didn't have a good relationship at all with my mother. And I only had the relationship with her through the caregiving. And when you do that, you have to be unattached to getting any sort of props, as I say. You know, it's sort of a crazy thing was in the last week of her life, I was with her during the hospice time, and in fact, my sister, who was very close to my mom, couldn't come down till the very end. My mother kept telling the hospice nurses how proud she was of all the work I was doing in the community. And I realized the entire time I was there, my mother thought I was my sister, who is a philanthropist, which is just goes to show you don't do it for the credit. You do it for the tikkun. That's what you do.
So listen, Annabelle, we've really talked a lot about people. And the truth is we don't really like people. we want to talk about something way more important that you address profoundly in your book, which is dogs.
Yes.
Now, both you and Mark Oppenheimer share very strong opinions about the state of, shall we say, pet pamperdom. What's going on?
Okay.
In the houndosphere.
Well, there is this chapter in my book about you know, whether or not, asking the question, are pets our family? And I come down decidedly that they are not, which just, by the way, when I talked about that on Bill Maher's show, I had to later post pictures on Twitter of me with my cats because—
Really, I love them.
I do love them.
People were so pissed off at me, like, I was
Annabelle Gorwich hates cats.
I love my cats, but they are not my children.
Mark, how would you answer that question? I'm curious. Are pets our family?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't spend money on my kids' clothes. I'm not going to spend money on my dog's clothes. I mean, I treat my dog with the same, you know, frugality that I treat my children. But my dog is definitely one of my children. Absolutely.
Okay, but I think it's gotten a fetishy and out of control.
Of course. No. Look, as our listeners know, I'm against purebreds. I'm against gourmet dogs. I'm against dressing them up in little booties. I'm against people who do those things. I mean, like, I believe in adopting rescue dogs of appropriate dog size that slobber over you and loving them as dogs.
I am too. In fact, in the book I talk about when I volunteered at a shelter rescue place. I was locked in a kennel with two.
I think we're on the same page. Using the nomenclature that they're family.
Okay,
that's
this
all.
Really important question is, do you know the Jewish stance on whether dogs have, you know, souls or not?
They don't, according to Judaism.
That's right. You're not supposed
which
to
is wrong.
Sit
yeah,
shiva
wrong.
For the rabbi will not do the shiva for the dogs.
We're not there yet. Okay. We're not there yet.
And yet we have bar mitzvahs.
I do believe the reform movement will get there to sitting shiva for dogs. Then conservative will follow. Then modern orthodoxy. And the Haredi will be left out there on the right wing fringe, not sitting shiva for dogs or counting them in the minyan, by the way. I mean, when I become president of my shul, we're counting dogs in the minyan. But only male dogs.
He's not kidding.
Hey, listen, you know, we can take this up next time you come back. But in the meantime, I feel like our listeners have to go buy your book, which is astonishing. Annabelle Gurwitch has been our Jew of the Week. Her book is Wherever You Go, There They Are, Stories About My Family You Might Relate To. And we did. So thanks. Thanks for being our JOTW.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When I get older, losing my head many years from now, will you still be sending me a Valentine? Birthday greetings, bottle of wine.
Our Gentile of the week is actually, it's a Jew-Gentile combo. We're cheating a bit because we wanted to have these guys in. It's the combo of actor Aaron Davidman and director Dylan Kussman, who together have made the movie Wrestling Jerusalem, which is playing all week until Friday, September 17th at Symphony Space here in New York City. Wrestling Jerusalem is a movie that I've seen, and I was up in Toronto where I moderated a discussion with these gentlemen and talked about their movie afterwards at the Toronto premiere. And it's a one-man show in which Aaron, who also wrote the script, plays about – how many characters do you play, Aaron?
17 last I counted.
I was going to say 25, but 17 characters
sometimes
on all
sides.
Sometimes it feels like 25. On all sides of the Israel-Palestine debate. Jews, Arabs, left-wingers, right-wingers, religious, secular, everything. He basically – it's like the whole Middle East argument in a nutshell. And it's a remarkable movie. Aaron, tell everyone – like, I think I've summed up the show pretty well, but how do you sum up the show?
You did it perfectly. I think what I could add is just that it's an attempt to try to move beyond polemic and, you know, into something that's more nuanced around this really thorny topic.
So tell us about, let's say, two or three of the characters whom you play, whose parts you wrote. These are fictional characters, but you wrote these parts.
Well,
tell us
yeah,
about them.
They're fictional. I mean, they're fictional now. They're all based on people that I interviewed.
Based on interviews you
yeah.
did.
Yeah. And
right?
then one of the characters, of course, is me, which isn't fictional.
Right.
That's last I checked.
As far as we know.
Yeah, like tell us about them maybe in the accents because you have about 10 accents going on.
Yeah, we should do it in inside the Shlomo studio. I would like to yeah. speak to the hardcore right-wing Israeli settler.
So this character, he believes very strongly about the right to be in the Judean Samaria. That particular character has a kind of... real religious zeal and justification for living in the West Bank, and yet he's also really human and really dimensional, and you can't just write him off.
Was there a specific character that was quite difficult to get into, or one that was more easy to get to? Where do they rank on like an emotional scale?
Well, you know, as a performer, as an actor, it's our job to, you know, go the distance all the way into that character, whatever they are. And so, in a way, it's kind of a delight to stretch myself into those different crevices and corners of my own psyche, you know? And I think the most surprising thing that came out was, if I have to be really honest, is actually how I could see little parts of myself in some of these people that I might, you know, judge more harshly or be critical of, you know, on a day-to-day basis. But when I have to go in and actually sell their ideas and embody them, I access parts of myself that I might not have wanted to kind of admit that were there. And I think that was the biggest surprise to me.
Aaron, give us one of the Arab characters. Give us some lines from one of the Arab characters you play.
Okay, so one of the guys says, the only Israelis I have known carry guns. The only Israelis I have known wear uniforms. The only Israelis I have known decide where I can live, where I can travel, when I can travel. The only Israelis my children have known drive tanks, invade neighborhoods, intimidate their parents at checkpoints. The only Israelis I have known own the water trucks that deliver my water.
I'm curious to know, what has the reaction been in the Palestinian community to the play or the film?
Well, I mean, Palestinians that have come to see the show, and first of all, it's a little bit of a hard sell actually to get Palestinians to come because I'm an American Jew telling part of telling their story. And that's, you know, as you can imagine, that's kind of a tough sell for them to come. But the ones that do come have approached me afterwards with a lot of respect and gratitude. There was when I was at the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis, there was a guy wearing a keffiyeh in the second row, you know, and I can see everybody in the audience, right? And so I'm doing the performance. I'm like, okay, there's a guy with a keffiyeh in the second row, and I know he's there wearing the keffiyeh to let me know that he's there,
right?
Right, and so at the end, when, you know, after the discussion, people were coming up to me, we were talking, he was kind of waiting his turn to chat with me. And I thought, okay, here it comes, here it comes. And he approached me and he said, he was maybe in his 30s. He says, I just want you to know my, you know, grew up in East Jerusalem. My my father's in, you know, was shot by the Israelis. He's in a, he's in Israeli prison. My, you know, cousin was killed. You know, this topic has been really, really tough for my family. I live in Toronto now. And I just want to tell you, here it comes. You nailed it.
Wow.
And so, you know, that that means a lot to me. Wow, and that's amazing. And, you know, I should say also that the perspectives of the Jewish right also are given as much dignity and respect in this piece than, you know, I mean, just as much as the Palestinian perspective or the more right or the more left Israeli perspective as well. So it's a whole, you know, it's a whole range, as you know, if you've seen it.
So Dylan, one of the privileges of your people, by which I mean Gentiles, is the, you know, the prerogative of not caring about this endless bloody conflict. So why did you enter in, into this fray? What's wrong with you?
And we should say, it's not like you don't have a good career, Dylan. I mean, you've worked on the Tom Cruise version of The Mummy, and you've worked on, you know, Mission Impossible. And, I mean, it's you, you've got other...
I went back to look at Dead Poets Society. I'll confess.
am I still...
You can still say it.
Still see Richard Cameron in there? Still see the Fink? It'll never go away. I came.
It's like you've got other fish to fry. I mean, you didn't have to delve into, you know, Ramallah.
Well, Aaron Davidman is one of my best friends in the world, and he has been for over a quarter century. I met him when I was going to college, and we've been longtime collaborators, and we've worked together on many different projects. And so there's a heartfelt connection between he and I follow his career very closely, and I'm always interested in what he's doing and what he's up to. And when I heard him first read this piece at a reading in Los Angeles, my soul was just immediately stirred. Whether it was the message of the piece, which is vast and multi-layered, or just a personal connection to Aaron himself as an actor and as a writer, watching him sort of find his voice, find something really big to say, something meaningful to say that I felt I wanted to help him share with the world. As for whether this topic is relevant to me as a Gentile, I think is, you know, this is a human issue. The world is in a lot of chaos. And there's a lot of conflict, and this issue has always been at the heart of that conversation from when I was a little boy. You know, when I was first sort of coming into any sort of political consciousness, when I was with my grandfather, and I asked him for the first time, I said, "What is going on in Israel? Why is it in the newspaper? I don't understand." And he said, "That's a problem that my generation created, and your generation will have to solve."
That's funny,
and I would never forget that. And I'm not saying that we're anywhere near achieving that, or that I'm any part of achieving that, but it's always stuck with me as it's important. And I had never come across any piece of art that addressed it so directly and so with so much humanity.
I actually have a question about the direction and the cinematography of the film, because it started out as a one-man show on the stage, and you have to translate that to film. And you did something really inventive, because it's split between scenes that play out on stage, backstage, and in a desert landscape. And then you, with very subtle use of props and panning and different angles, you give it a lot of depth and dimension. And you have to see it for our listeners to really experience it. But can you talk a little bit about how you came up with that, just how you took this stage show and made it into this cinematic thing?
Well, first thing, Nicole Whitaker, director of photography. Second, Nicole Whitaker, director of photography.
You need to mention also Nicole Whitaker,
also,
the cinematographer.
We should mention her. She did an incredible job of translating my sort of ideas and visions into reality and making the film up on screen, the one that I had was trying to see. Ultimately, I like to think that the film is some sort of translation of what I see in my head when I watch Aaron perform the play. Aaron's Aaron's embodiment of these characters is so vivid, and his evocation of place is so powerful that I see places, I see things, I see the home where he goes for the dinner, I see the kitchen where he has the argument with the student, and I wanted to, and I so the film became trying to manifest my fever dream of the show into a form that I could show to other people.
But also without it being too literal, not like literally
right.
going to, you know, create realistic scenes in those
right.
places either.
Right.
You know, more imaginative.
Abstracted.
Yeah.
Abstracted. And every time we tried to go to, instead of just suggesting a kitchen in the middle of this dry lake bed with these chairs and tables, going to an actual kitchen in our minds as we conceived of the movie, it lost all its power. It lost all its power because the power of the play is that it's just Aaron on stage and he takes you on this journey, this incredible journey that he actually took through these places and through these people. And the movie had to do the same right. thing while at the same time being more than just a three-camera shoot of a live stage performance. It still had to take you but not take you.
So Aaron, on that note, let me ask you this. This is such an intense performance. I mean, it's evident just from watching and you sort of like coil up. How do you unwind from something like that? You do it on stage and then it's like 9:30, 9:45. You're like, okay, I'm done for the night.
Whiskey.
Is that what you do?
Well, it's also about how do I prepare to do it? So I have a yoga practice before every performance. That's gets me kind of all aligned. And then afterwards, I'm pretty wiped out. So usually I might have a glass of whiskey and go to bed.
To de-Israel Palestine.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
One of the remarkable things about watching him do the performance is how quickly he transitions from one character to the other. And the film tries to, you know, does achieve it through edits. But just watching him physically do it, you realize his skill at being able to immediately, he's so invested in each human being that you go, you must be way down in the well and you're never going to get out. And he, within a second, has turned into someone else and you realize how fast he's let it go. I find that remarkable about him, that I agree with you. To come backstage after seeing him do it for 90 minutes, you're looking at him like, are you okay?
Yeah.
I just acted. It was crazy.
It's like the theater equivalent of running a marathon. You can just do that.
Can I leave you with one little flavor of a character that I was thinking of that might...
Please.
He kind of balances out...
Please.
This is Avram, the settler equivalent or parity with Ibrahim, the Palestinian that I gave earlier.
Parity, P-A-R-I-T-Y.
Not a parody.
No, not a parody. There is a reason we are called Jews. We are descendants of the kingdom of Judah. And there is power in names, Aharon. Aharon, nachon? Ata ha-kohen? Ah, you could be a kohen, you know this? Psst. It's a very big honor to be descendant of the high priests. You think Star Trek invented this? God was going where no man had gone before. Long before Spock and Captain Kirk.
You realize, so Aaron, what you don't know is that Liel is not uninterested in Star Trek.
Yes.
We'll just put it that way. So you know, marrying the priestly blessing, you know, bringing Star Trek back to its roots.
It's the intersection that is Liel.
That's right.
The Jew-Gentile combo of actor-writer Aaron Davidman and director Dylan Kussman have together made the movie Wrestling Jerusalem, which is playing all week at Symphony Space through Sunday at 7:30 p.m. in New York City. But also, you can find out more about it at WrestlingJerusalem.com. And also, I just want to say, if you want to have a conversation at your synagogue or community center or college campus or about the Middle East – that where you're not the one who gets yelled at, where you basically can present all sides and then have a conversation right. and you know they'll hate someone else
or
for
State Department for that matter.
Yeah, I mean,
you
like
just do a Jared.
No,
Kushner
seriously,
special. Yeah,
there's something so you know when I was in the audience at Toronto or when I was and then moderating the discussion afterwards with these gentlemen, there is something quite disarming about it because you've seen them ventriloquize all, you've seen them perform all sides. So it's not like you can play gotcha and say, but what about the settler point of view? Or what about the intifada? Or what about, because it's been there. So it's a remarkable piece of work. And I want to thank Aaron Davidman and Dylan Kussman for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Friends, I've told you this before, but I will tell you again. There are some live shows coming up. September 16th, this Saturday, I will be speaking at Barnard Temple in Franklin Lakes, New Jersey. I'll be giving their Slichot talk about stuff. It'll be a lot of fun. If you're anywhere in Jersey, you know, I mean, if you're in New York, you can cross a bridge. You can come see me. You can go through a tunnel. But if you're in Jersey, you know, just come. Just hop on the beautiful scenic Garden State Parkway or Jersey Turnpike and turn up. I would love for some fans of the show to come. I would love to have a little cheering section there. October 18th, I'll be giving a public lecture at West Virginia University. And October 25th, the whole gang, all of us, will be doing another unorthodox live show at JCC Manhattan. You can go to jccmanhattan.org and get tickets right now. We are booking some outstanding guests for that show. We'll have full lineup to come. But remember, we've sold out this show before. So do get your tickets. That's JCC Manhattan, October 25th. Come see us live. And we have more shows to announce coming up soon. But that's what we got on the schedule right now. Some newsletter subscribers. Oh, many people have joined the newsletter community this week, which, remember, it's a special unorthodox newsletter. Even if you get the regular Tablet newsletter, this is a special one for you. This week, we welcome to the partnership of our law firm, Shelley Rubenfire, Lydia Lazar, Madeline Cohen, Blair Cooper, Adam Levy, Chava Katibian, Jared Fisher, Emily Rose Schmick, Sarah Geiger, Allison Friedman, Sam Gabor, John Newman, and longtime listener Rachel Leventhal Weiner, possessor of the most Jewish name in America. But the woman we have to talk about, the person we have to talk about, Shelley Rubenfire. Alyssa, what do we know about a new newsletter subscriber, Shelley Rubenfire?
Well, I can tell you about the Rubenfire family mythology. Shelley's grandfather came to the United States as an immigrant somewhere in Eastern Europe. The family name was Rabinovich. And what happened was, it was around the early 1900s, somewhere in Chicago, young Rabinovich, still single, he fell into a boisterous Jewish crowd. There was a poker game one night. Things got out of hand. They ended up at a deli. And at the deli, there was a wager.
Where is this going?
Over who could eat the most Reubens. It was $50, which was a lot of money back then. And Shelley's grandfather ate 4 Reubens, which is like massive, and therefore received the moniker Reuben Fear, because fear is 4 in Yiddish, and became Reuben Fire. And 2 generations later, we have Shelley.
Amen to that. Wow. Impossible to argue with this.
Shelley, welcome to the community. The newsletter, again, is not the regular Tablet newsletter. To get the special Liel Leibowitz penned unorthodox newsletter, sign up on our website, tabletmag.com, or send an email asking for it and putting it in the subject line to unorthodox@tabletmag.com. Okay, to the mailbox. Dear Unorthodox, I did not grow up Jewish. My family were not regular churchgoers, but they more or less lined up with evangelical Protestants. Throughout my teen years in the late 80s, I found myself in a crisis of faith. By chance, in 1991, I visited a bookstore in my town. As was my habit, I checked out the religion section and found the book Jewish Literacy by Rabbi Joseph Telushkin. I read a few pages and knew I had to have it. I had found my home. Eventually, I escaped my small town and continued my journey. I converted and officially became a Jew as soon as I was able to find a Jewish community and a rabbi who would teach me. That was many years ago, and I've gone through many challenges and changes while on my Jewish journey. And ultimately, after losing my marriage, my family, and everything I once held dear, I found myself again in the proverbial wilderness. It took a while, but I started getting my life back together with a new job and a new life. In December, while looking for Jewish podcasts, I found Unorthodox. After hearing the Christmas 2016 episode, I decided to download your entire archive and listen from the beginning. It took until shortly after Passover to catch up to the latest show. Your podcast has helped me feel reconnected to my faith, my community, and my joy. You may never know how fully you've helped make a difference in people's lives, but you have and continue to do so every week. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. Sincerely, Benjamin T. McCormick.
I was afraid he's going to say, and after listening to your podcast, I decided to convert back away from whatever it is you guys are.
We are in some ways the litmus test. Like, if you can handle us, you can stay.
Yeah, and you're a Jew.
If the Holocaust jokes and sort of rank irreverence and apostasy don't sit well with you, there are other easier faiths. Anyway, Ben, if we may call you Ben, thank you. It means the world to us. And you did, by the way, ask if our producer Shira Talushkin was any relation. It could pass the word of thanks on to Joseph Talushkin, and she can. And now a final letter. Alyssa, do you want to do the honors?
I do. Hi, guys. I'm a big fan of the podcast. A year and a half ago, I left my job in New York to travel around South America. My plan was to travel for a year, but I'm still here and still going. As a solo traveler, podcasts are essential to me to combat loneliness, sleepless nights, and long, endless bus rides. And the people in my favorite podcast sort of feel like friends of mine. Your podcast is one of the ones I never miss an episode of. I have a problem, though, and this has happened to me with other podcasts. I have no idea what you three look like. Part of me has the urge to Google some photos of you, but another part of me is scared. Not necessarily of what you actually look like, but rather of destroying the images I already have in my own imagination of what you look like. So, what do you think? Should I Google the photos or stick to the imaginary versions? Best, Daniel Labicki.
Oof.
What a conundrum.
Leo, what do you think? Should he find out what we look like, or just have us? I mean, here's my answer.
As I've told to every girl I've ever chatted with online, no, you shouldn't probably ever do that.
Right. I mean, it's good to know you're still chatting with girls online.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, Lisa.
Here's the way I feel about that, which is I think it depends what you think we look like. I mean, if you think, for example, that I'm 6'1" with green eyes and a pyramid shaped torso, then you should stick with that.
And as for me, imagine a grizzly bear breaking into a closet and emerging with a t-shirt, and that's pretty much what I look like.
Dan, here's what I think Mr. Labicki should do. Will you do us this solid? Google us, and then I want a really thoughtful letter about how we meet or don't meet your expectations. Like, really drill down. Look at a bunch of pictures of us, and then write to us and tell us, are we better looking, worse looking, different looking? We want true and utter candor.
All
nothing
he will write is,
happier.
I've Googled you and I've decided to stay in South America.
All right, so mazel tov. Liel, what you got this week?
So obviously, I mean, look, the mazel tov here is to the Butnick Cohen clans,
for
to
sure,
Stephanie,
for sure,
to Ben, to all of them. But I want to extend a really heartfelt note. This is a mazel tov / get well soon thing. There is a man in Hebron named Mohammed Jabbar. Mohammed Jabbar, when he was younger, used to be a member of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad terrorist group. And one day he started, you know, reading his religion more seriously. And he had a change of heart. He did teshuva. He converted. He became, I mean, not converted out of Islam, but converted out of terrorism and became a peace activist. And this Eid al-Adha, which just happened, the sacrifice festival, the Islamic sacrifice festival, Muhammad Jabbar invited his good friend Yehuda Glick, who is a religious Jew and a member of Knesset from the Likud party in Israel, over for some coffee and pastries. And Yehuda Glick was very happy to go. And you know, they posted a lovely photo of all of them with Jabbar's children on Facebook. And a few days later, because of that photograph, the Palestinian police arrested Mohammed Jabbar for the crime of having coffee with an Israeli. And you know what? I think that every person here, regardless of religion, regardless of political opinion, who still believes that the absolute pinnacle we're aspiring to is just two friends, you know, wishing each other a happy holiday and having coffee. Every person needs to pray for Mohammed Jabbar's quick and safe release.
You're here. Alyssa.
My mazel tov is for my friend Bram Presser in Melbourne, Australia, who wrote a wonderful novel called The Book of Dirt. It has just come out. I highly recommend it. It's really beautiful and extraordinary. It's about his grandparents and the Holocaust. It is a novel. It's kind of metafictional, and it's about the stories we tell as families about our family histories and what is true and what isn't and how we fill in the gaps. And very relevant to our interview with Annabelle today, actually. And just check it out if you can. It's a great book.
My Mazel Tov's two quickies and a slightly longer one. First off, a big Mazel Tov, a birthday Mazel Tov, and shout out to our listener, Joe Temi. Got this from your hubby, and I understand you are two of our many, many Gentile listeners. I think like 30 or 40% of our listeners are not Jews. And we wish you a major happy birthday, Joe. Second, of course, the big mega Mazel Tov to Butnick Cohen and the merger of two of the dynastic Jewish families of the tri-state area. And then finally, a special Mazel Tov. Last spring, I taught a class at Yale on podcasting, which, you know, I don't think any university's ever offered a class on podcasting before. I mean, the idea was, let's look at this as an art form and talk about what makes this different from radio, from literature, from all these other things. And then the final project was each student, there were 15 students, had to produce an episode of a podcast about undergraduate life at Yale. And they produced 15 of the most amazing episodes ever. One is about naked parties at Yale. Another is about secret societies. Another one is about why all the varsity athletes take Indonesian as their foreign language, which is hilarious. Another one is about class at Yale, about what it's like to be poor at an Ivy League school. Honestly, they have over 1,000 downloads so far. And everyone I've talked to who's listened to it has said, this is the bomb. The podcast is called Undergraduate Admissions, and you can get it on iTunes or Stitcher, and they have a website, which is uapodcast.com. Seriously, just give them a listen. Give them a download. Give them a listen. One of them is about an Orthodox Jewish girl who got to Yale and then lost her faith as the result of having been sexually assaulted and how the religious community handled it. Like, honestly, I could just keep – I'm not going to list all 15, but Undergraduate Admissions, uapodcast.com, or find them on iTunes and give these kids some love. Unorthodox is brought to you by Tablet Magazine, on the web at tabletmag.com. Write to us at unorthodox@tabletmag.com. Follow Mrs. Stephanie on Instagram at sbutnick. We are on Facebook a lot. Just follow Tablet Magazine. Our executive producer is Alyssa Goldstein, and we are also produced by Shira Talushkin. Our artwork is by Esther Werdiger. Our show is edited by Noach Levinson. Our music is by Golem. Rabbinic supervision by Rabbi Don Rossoff of Barnard Temple in Franklin Lakes, New Jersey, where I'll be speaking on Saturday. Kosher slaughtering by Hurricane Irma. We recorded Argo Studios, which caught the bouquet, and we're proud to be part of the Panoply Network. Shalom, friends.